Hello and welcome to our symposium today on Choices and Dignity in Dying for End of Life University. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I'm so glad that you've joined us today to take part in this discussion. I originally got the idea to do this as a topic with a live call-in session last fall when the death with dignity laws really started receiving attention in our country due to Brittany Maynard and her choice to move to Oregon and end her life using the death with dignity law in Oregon. And there was so much heated discussion around the topic at that time. I felt like it would be a very good subject for us to consider and talk about together through End of Life University. I wanted to wait a little while until some of the emotions quieted down after everything that was stirred up last fall. And that's what I'm looking for today, hoping that we can have some conversation and discussion about death with dignity, about the right to die, about the right to physician-aided dying. And I'd love hearing opinions and thoughts from all perspectives during this conversation. So for those of you joining us, I'm so glad that you're here today and willing to chime in on this conversation. And I have two co-hosts with me that I'm happy to welcome, Phyllis Schachter, and I've interviewed her last fall about her TEDx documentary, Not Here by Choice, which covered the death of her husband, Alan, by voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. And Phyllis will be sharing more of her ideas with us. So welcome, Phyllis.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm so glad that you're here. And my other co-host is Arlene Hinckley, who was just interviewed, and you may have heard her interview this past Thursday. She's a secretary of the board and a client support volunteer for Compassion and Choices of Washington. Arlene, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this series.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Well, I'll point out to those of you who have called in on the telephone how you can participate. Your phone line currently is muted, but in order to ask a question as our conversation goes on, all you need to do is press star 2 on the keypad of your phone, and that will alert me that you have a question to ask, and then I'll unmute your line, and you'll be able to talk with Arlene and Phyllis. If you're listening to us over the computer, to the webcast, you can type in a question on the screen where you're listening. There's a little question box, and you can type in your question and submit it there. And I will read your question out loud, and then we'll discuss that question as well. So please feel free to gather your own thoughts and put your questions together, because we'd be delighted to hear from you and hear what you would like to talk about. So I'm going to kick off the discussion myself by raising an issue that has been of concern for me in the past about the death with dignity laws. And that issue is, does a patient hastening the end of their life, even when they have a terminal illness, does that constitute suicide? And initially, in my thinking, I believed that it did, and I've heard this from a number of other doctors, that suicide is suicide, no matter what reason someone does it for. If someone uses any means to end their own life, that's a suicide. And if you've heard me talk in the past, you know that my own father committed suicide many years ago. And his death was extremely traumatic for me and for my entire family. We spent years and years dealing with our grief and guilt over his death. So for me, the very idea of that I, as a doctor, would help a patient commit suicide was just unthinkable for me. I couldn't imagine that I would do it. I couldn't imagine that I would... help a patient do something that would cause that similar pain to family members and loved ones that I've spent my life dealing with. So, and I've heard other doctors bring this up, including Dr. Ira Byock, during the discussions about death with dignity last fall, that it doesn't seem appropriate for doctors to support suicide. I had that idea in mind, and until I had conversations with our two co-hosts today, Phyllis and Arlene. And this is one of the, what I'm telling you, the value of having conversation and discussion and listening to people's stories and their experiences is that it can change your mind and open your heart. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing this entire series and bringing people together and bringing up topics like this, so that all of us can learn some new information and can relook at our ideas and how we think. So I wanted to invite my two co-hosts to talk with me a little bit about their thoughts and experiences about this idea: when a patient uses the death with dignity law, is it suicide? And I'll start with Arlene and ask you if you would share Compassion and Choice's point of view on that question.
Sure. This is a question that comes up frequently, and I very purposely do not use the word suicide. There are, of course, people who will point to the definition in the dictionary of suicide, but our language is not fixed. It changes. It's not static. And we don't use the word icebox anymore, and 10 years ago we didn't have the word app. So things change. Particularly in our society, the word suicide has a very negative connotation. If you think about your image of a suicide, it's probably done by someone alone. It's often violent. It's done by a person who could live if they chose to, but they choose not to. And we think of people like terrorists or love-struck teenagers. If you think about a person choosing an assisted death or death with dignity, that is a long-thought-out, rational decision made in consultation with physicians, family, clergy, if that's appropriate. It's a decision that's made by a person who would dearly love to live if they could, but they are not able to choose that option. It's an act that's carried out in the presence of loved ones or whomever the patient chooses to have there. It's a very gentle, peaceful act. The act of an assisted death changes the timing of an inevitable death. People who are contemplating using the law, or the survivors of people who have used the law, find this the use of the word suicide very hurtful. And actually, there are many professional organizations that agree that this does not constitute suicide, including American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, American Medical Student Association, American College of Legal Medicine, American Public Health Association, and the list goes on.
Well, thank you. And I have to say, Arlene, in our discussion, it was very helpful to me to hear you make that distinction between a rational choice to end one's life a little earlier than it would be ending anyway, and an irrational choice made in extreme pain and fear and depression and other reasons that might accompany a suicide, such as I experienced with my father.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Phyllis, you as a family member, I wanted to hear your perspective about Alan's death by voluntarily stopping eating and drinking, your husband, Alan. And you heard me describe kind of the guilt and the grief that my family went through that was devastating for years and due to his suicide death. And I wanted to ask you, do you in any way look at Alan's death as a suicide, and how, what comments do you have about that?
Okay, that's a great question. I am so glad you're bringing this up, and it's something that I actually address now when I have been speaking to groups as a way of sharing our story. I first need to put in context just Alan's situation before I can talk about the conscious dying versus suicide, just so the listeners know that my husband at the end of 2011, 6 weeks apart, was diagnosed with both laryngeal cancer and Alzheimer's. And after some deep reflection, he said no to the three surgeries that the surgeon said he would need to have, or else he would die a painful death within 6 to 12 months. And in fact, when he said no to those surgeries, Alan did become a client of Compassion and Choices of Washington and did qualify for the Death with Dignity law and prescription because he didn't want to die a horrible death from laryngeal cancer. In 4 months, through alternative means, my husband healed of cancer naturally. And about 3 months later, a couple months later, it became apparent that the Alzheimer's, in the course of a week, it became so apparent that the Alzheimer's was really taking over and that there was no going back, that this was progressing considerably. And so that happened in maybe the summer of 2012. And by the fall of 2012, we were actively in conversation about choices that were available to him. So he did not, if he chose not to live into the late stages of Alzheimer's, and many people in his family, including his mother, had Alzheimer's, and my father had it, and we knew what lay ahead for him, and his mom just died a shadow of a person with no physical capacity. It's a horrible way to die, in my opinion, and it was in his opinion. So by the fall of 2012, we were in active conversation about what to do and were there any other choices. And at that point, I was in pretty close conversation with Compassion and Choices of Washington, and which was, it was so remarkable to have the support of this wonderful organization. Everybody was very kind and helpful. And I spoke, I was referred to one of their chaplains who told me about voluntary stopping eating and drinking, and I did some legal research, and it was from the legal research, a long paper written by Thaddeus Pope, who's a bioethics attorney and professor, that convinced me and Alan, as a result of reading this information, that he could stop eating and drinking and have a peaceful death, a good death, and that it was completely legal. So Alan and I are, I would say that we both have lived somewhat unconventional lives, but I guess we could say that about everybody in varying degrees with different regard to different details in their life. But we felt we had nothing to hide, and we were public about what we were doing every step of the way. And I was Alan's advocate, trying to make sure everything went really smoothly for him because he didn't have the capacity to do this. But he was mentally competent. And around the late fall of 2012, he made the decision that he would stop eating and drinking. He just didn't know when he would do it. And the whole thing about suicide, you know, began to come up fairly soon after as people in the community began to hear about it. And, you know, some people felt it was wrong. You know, and they felt, well, he can still eat and drink now, and he can walk a little and talk a little, and he's still mentally competent. He has some quality of life left. But we also knew that he was walking a timeline and that he would not be able, he wouldn't have the capacity to be able to follow through with not eating and drinking if he was not mentally competent. So my husband, now to address a little bit more directly, one part that was very difficult for me personally was he loved life. He had a great life, and he wanted to live every day that he could. And so he kept changing the date, and yet at the same time, and stretching it out, and yet at the same time we had an agreement that if I felt he was losing his mental capacity, that I would tell him. And we ended up actually having that conversation. He did not remember the agreement we made, but he clearly was cognizant of the conversation. And it was soon after that he set the exact date. So in this context, my husband absolutely, you know, loved his life, and he had probably one of the most conscious, loving ways of departing from this earth is I think is imaginable, because as Karen just said, suicide is violent. It's outside the natural order. It's an emotional decision and perception. It's done with emotional imbalance. It's done, you know, secretively. And truly, for my husband, this was about self-love and peace and compassion. And he was very grateful for the good life he had, and he was grateful for having the choice to VSED and not have to live into the late stages of Alzheimer's. People have asked me if I have felt any guilt, and I would say I have truly and honestly, I have felt absolutely no guilt. I have felt deep grief. I had a very deep grieving process, but I did not feel guilt at all. And his daughter knew about it. His sister knew about it. My daughter, our grandchildren, they were all able to say goodbye to him. We had friends come for months who he had known for many, many years who came and stayed with us and said their goodbyes. And I actually have here, I knew what we were doing was out of the ordinary, and I kept some pretty close good files and notes about conversations he and I had. And these are some actual words that he spoke to me 2 months before he started his fast. This is a direct quote. "I am comfortable and at ease with everything. I just feel great all the time, even when I'm tired. I'd love to help people reduce their suffering. People notice how happy I look. I think that's because I'm really at the end of this life. I'm sure it goes on. I don't know how to share this with other people. It's up to you, Phyllis, to do that." So that's kind of a longer answer to your question about suicide, Karen, putting it in a bigger context.
Thank you, Phyllis, and that is what I what I was wanting to hear from you, that the guilt that my family experienced after my dad's death isn't there for you, because this was a rational choice, and because you were part of the whole process of observing and watching him make the decision and going through each step of the phase, and so definitely, when you look at that death versus the death of my dad, they're not the same thing. And so it doesn't seem right to label them with the same word. And
I think of what Alan did as conscious dying. And it's so important that we broaden the perspective about the choices available to people leading up to and during the dying process.
And we have a comment that came in through the webcast from Dee Evers. She wrote, "As the word suicide is repugnant, what term is best used?" She wrote, "I like self-deliverance, which infers that the decision is mine, which I so strongly feel." So that's an interesting thought to you, that we need different words to describe what we're talking about here, because suicide is far too emotionally charged and stigmatized as a word, and it doesn't convey the whole picture of what we're looking at.
Karen, I would also add that assisted dying, planned death, hastened death, there are many terms that are used for this, death with dignity. Although I caution people, there are many ways to die with dignity. So we don't want to monopolize that term in any way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to remind our listeners, if you've called in on the phone line and you have a comment or question, you can just press *2 on the keypad of your phone, and that will alert me that you'd like to say something, and then I'll unmute your line. and you can speak with us. So please don't hesitate to do that if a question comes up from you. And those of you who are listening on the webcast, you can type in your questions and comments. And I'm going back there to check to see if we have anything else here. All right. I also wanted to mention the fact that I think that you mentioned this, Arlene, in our conversation, that there are currently 25 states, is that correct, that are considering death with dignity laws across the country?
I think that's a correct estimate. I'm not sure of the exact number, but it is in the 20s, yes.
Okay. And then also we recently heard that the Canadian Parliament just lifted their ban on physician-aided dying.
Mm-hmm.
So things are changing pretty rapidly in our country and Canada and possibly other countries in the world. And my state of Colorado is currently considering a death with dignity law. And I know that we have a caller, Bart Windrum, has been active in that movement. And Bart, I know you're listening in, so I'd like to unmute your line if you'd be willing to share with us what you know about what's happening here in Colorado. So let's see, I'm going to... okay, Bart, your line is unmuted. If you'd be willing to share with us.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Are you hearing me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Bart.
Yeah, so briefly, actually, the nascent aided dying effort in Colorado was defeated on its first attempt. I had thought and hoped, because I support this, fervently support it and want it wholeheartedly, but it didn't make it out of the public health committee meeting. And the Republicans are dominant in our Senate right now. The Democrats control the House. And there's some party line aspect to this, according to some of the folks at Compassion and Choices that I've spoken with. So nobody expected it to become law this year in Colorado. I personally was surprised that it went down in committee. I thought it would make it to the House floor. I was at the State House. I got there early. I was one of the first to sign up to testify, but I didn't get to testify until several hours into the hearing, which lasted for 11 or so hours into the, you know, well after dark. And this will be reintroduced. Roland Halpern of Compassion and Choices told me that on average it takes 5 to 6 attempts to get this sort of legislation enacted in any given state. And in Hawaii, of all places, I think it's been introduced 14 times and has failed all the way. In Vermont, it went through on the first try last year. But it's under a very different model. And there are basically three ways that aided dying can be legalized in any jurisdiction. One is through citizen ballot initiative, as out west. Another is legislatively, as what happened in Vermont, and very different programs. They modeled theirs under on the Oregon law for the first several years, and then that's going to sunset, and it will change to medical practice of care, best care practices. Nobody knows what's going to happen when that occurs. And then in New Mexico and Montana, which are two states that are cited as the five where aided dying is legal. I personally don't see it that way. It was done by the courts. The Montana Supreme Court decreed that physicians could not be prosecuted for assisting, because under their constitution, individual liberty ranks pretty high. That's my understanding of it. I could be off on a detail. And down in New Mexico, a district court found in some way that supports aided dying, and that's got to go through the court processes. So it's not like there are programs in place there where people are doing things. But the reason I had asked to take part in this conversation was to share my observations from the Colorado effort. I'm very troubled by what I saw, and this is the same sort of stuff that has gone down in other states. And I just have to speak plainly. And it's about, because what happened was the disabled community, specifically their activist leaders, held sway. Some people think that it was a party line vote in the committee. I don't know because I'm not involved in politics, but they very clearly, for one reason or another, held the day, and their arguments were cited by the committee members who voted this nascent effort down. So first, a disclaimer. I have nothing against disabled people. In fact, my sister is mobility impaired and has other long-term lifelong conditions. She actually supports aided dying. She used to be a Colorado resident, and she lives in Florida now. But I sat through these things, and I drew some conclusions, and I'm going to share them. And again, with all my end-of-life work, I've always felt that we want to die in peace, however we define it. So we have to ask some hard questions. What stands in our way? And my allegiance is to answering those questions. And if it seems to hurt or sound mean or cast a light on what other people say, that sort of goes with the territory. And the best we can do is set forth our viewpoints respectfully, but I can't shirk from the responsibility I feel to set them forth clearly. And here's what I experienced that day at the State House. First, everyone is treated with the utmost of respect. And hats off to all the staff and all the legislators and all the participants. You know, we know we're treading on sensitive ground that is very important to everybody, no matter our viewpoint and feelings. But I felt from the outset that deference was paid to the disabled activist leaders, and I use those three words very specifically. I came away from the day questioning it. And the deference was, the sign-up process was a mess. I got there way early in the morning because I wanted to speak early enough. I had things to do that afternoon. And I wound up not being able to speak for 2 hours, and the only reason I was is because I went to the green jacketed guys, and then I was able to speak with the committee chair as she came off the dais on a break and explain the trouble I had. And he sent, without going into the details, the sign-up process was not well managed by the staff, and all the sign-up sheets get commingled. So it doesn't even matter if you signed up early. They have no way of knowing it. So what they did, the process was someone would speak for it, someone would speak against it, and you ping-ponged all day long. Well, they gave speaking preference positions to all the disabled activists. So as most of the morning ensued, those who were speaking against it early were disabled activists, and they're very impassioned and very powerful because they're very scared. And there's an irony here. Now, I can't speak to all their constituency, but the irony is that essentially the arguments that they present are fear-based. They say they're afraid of potential dire outcomes and consequences and actions against them at some future date. But the activists themselves are among the strongest people I have ever seen. Now, they got a lot of cards stacked against them. You know, one was there in a wheelchair with oxygen and she said, look, I'm fine. I'm a lawyer. I have 4 adopted children. 2 of them are in wheelchairs. I mean, this woman is amazing. She's very strong. She said, I would die if we unplugged my stuff here. In 4 hours, I would be gone. But they trade on fears. And I have trouble accepting the fears. I'm not going to explicate them right now. I'm afraid I would take too long on the phone. But what's always occurred to me, and they talk in terms of a slippery slope. We've all heard that. And I think 2 things get lost in the conversation. Number one, we've all been on a slippery slope for 4 generations. And I bet you that there are dozens of people dying during that 11-hour committee hearing in ways that they probably didn't want to be dying. And that's real and everyday and present right now. And I just have and another point that they did raise, 1 of the 3 that I will reiterate here, is that they voiced a fear that if aided dying were legal, and they were eligible for the lethal prescription and they took it, that they would just go home and ingest it and kill themselves, essentially. And what I think gets lost is that it's very hard for all of us in midlife, whether we're 40 or 60, to project ahead. Even with dying people in the room, there were literally people who were dying that had to struggle to come up and had their spouse speak for them because they couldn't even speak. It doesn't get through that what we're trying to do is project 20, 30 years into the future to make that distinction between an irrational suicide and looking for a peaceful way out when there is no way out, when all the doors are closed. And so I just wanted to point some of these things out because it's not atypical. We know that for those who are in favor of aided dying, that the Catholic Church and the disabled community are the two big forces against this. But as I witnessed how the disabled community worked that day and what they said, the fears were all hypothetical. And for me, it strained credulity to think that anyone would ingest the cocktail, as I call it, a moment before you actually wanted to, and certainly if you're not dying. I can only imagine that if you're dying, you probably know it.
That's so interesting. And Bart, I was wondering if we could ask Arlene to chime in, because I know that you mentioned, Arlene, that Compassion and Choices in Washington had also had some opposition from
the
disabled community. Yes.
Yes, and I sympathize with you very much. During our campaign, the disabled community was very active. They continue to be active throughout the country through a group called Not Dead Yet. Mm-hmm. And in fact, at the I believe it was September meetings of the World Right to Die Society Federation in Chicago, they tried to obstruct the meetings, even tried to bait some Death with Dignity proponents into physical confrontations. The important thing to remember is that these are a small vocal minority of people with disabilities. Studies show that the people with disabilities want this right in the same proportion that everybody else wants it. These very vocal folks mean well, but they do not speak for the disabled community. And I think, you know, do not want to minimize disability in any way. But in this context, disability is simply irrelevant. You must have a terminal illness expected to take your life within 6 months to qualify for the law.
Regardless of disability.
Yes, yes.
So the fear mentioned that if it were legal, we would all go home and ingest the cocktail right now.
Yeah.
That's not even possible. That couldn't even happen unless they had a terminal illness.
Right, right. And the states, most of the states who have allowed Death with Dignity have a very rigorous and pretty complicated qualification process with built-in waiting periods, so that this is not a hasty decision. And also, I've worked with, probably 200 folks in Washington State who have contemplated using the law, and it just is not in people's nature to take a lethal dose of medication prematurely.
Karen, am I still alive?
You are, Bart, so go ahead if you'd like to comment.
Yeah, just so folks know, I think forewarned is forearmed, and I'm not sure, you know, I really would have to talk to legislators, and I'm not sure they'd talk to me about why they allowed themselves to be swayed. Was it just party line? Was it an excuse? I haven't a clue. I don't know. But one of the arguments that the disabled activists were making was this is all within the context of qualifying under the law, as I stated, that their identities would be hijacked, that someone else would apply pretending to be them, go through the process, obtain the medication, and then force them to take it.
Oh my
I'm
goodness.
Not exaggerating. This was what they said. And the idea of precipitously, so if a lot, some of these disabled folks might qualify, they might have terminal illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, and under that context, precipitously taking, a lethal prescription. So that was just my experience, my observations and reflections. And I think that part of the solution for those of us who want to see this enacted is we really do need to flood all the legislators involved, most especially those who represent us in our own districts. They need to know how many of us. In fact, it was only because Lois Court received many hundreds of supportive contacts after the guy, I don't remember his name, he's dead now, here in Colorado, published an op-ed pleading to them. You know, that's what got the ball moving. That and Brittany, of course.
You know, I'd like to just chime in here a little bit about this, because legislators, whether they're liberal, conservative, Democrat, or Republican, are humans first. And I think the issue starts with such a vast fear of people even talking about death. Because if you're talking about death, then you have to think of your own death. And we are not comfortable in this culture talking about death. And so part of the whole, part of this conversation, I don't mean just what we're having now, but part of the larger conversation that has to happen culturally all over, but certainly in our country, is just people getting more comfortable with impermanence, with understanding that they are going to die. And so, I mean, I talk with people. I talk so openly about this now. And it frightens a lot of people because they haven't even begun to confront their own mortality, and they may be over 50 years old. And so when we're in these public situations, we're always up against people who are projecting also from their own experience. And so when I talk about it, I just try to talk about it as much as I can from my heart. I mean, I think the biggest gift that I personally, this is a human, received from walking through this with my husband was the lessening of my own fear and acceptance that I am going to die. And consequently, I cherish every day so much now. So I think that's part of the equation. Even though it's not directly about the topic, you know what I'm saying? It's not directly in the way that you're presenting it today, Karen, but I felt it was important to interject this perspective. Because it's
well, you're exactly right, Phyllis, and it means that we have a lot of work to do because we have a lot of educating to do, and we have to bring about a lot of societal change to get
absolutely, and that's why the death cafes are so great in terms of what's happening in the country, because you know that in quite a few cities now in the country, this actually, I believe, started in England, people get together once a month at a death cafe, and they can, at our death cafe in Bellingham, when you walk in, there are maybe 7 or 8 tables, and there's a placard on each table with some aspect having to do with death and dying, and you can sit at whatever table you want and enter into a discussion about it. And then you can move from table to table. And it's really more about people expressing their perspectives and their feelings and their needs. It's not about what's right and what's wrong. And I believe that this is an important step in getting people comfortable. It's a good tool.
Thank you, Phyllis. Bart, your line is still open, and I wanted to tell you Tammy typed in a question on the webcast that applies to this discussion, so I wanted, Bart, for you to stay on the line. She writes, I am a resident of the state of Oregon, and I have ALS. This topic is of major interest to me. What changes do you anticipate may occur regarding the Death with Dignity law? Bart brought up a slight reference to this topic, so I'm not sure if there was something that you mentioned, Bart, about changes.
I think, Karen, the only thing I mentioned is my understanding, and I could be wrong, is that the Oregon and Washington law, weren't they citizen initiatives? They were voted on by ballot. And
yes.
There may have been some court fights against them, but it was one of three paths. So I can't speak to any detail or any aspect of the Oregon law except that we all know it's been around for, what, 17 years in effect, and probably longer at its first inception. So it's well proven. I suspect that everybody up there knows what's so and how to access and utilize it. And if you don't, call the Oregon branch of Compassion and Choices, and I think anyone wanting to use it up there will be squared away. The reason I mentioned that there are these three different legal approaches to making aided dying legal is because they probably have different ramifications, right? If it's legislated, you can probably cross the T's and dot some I's perhaps more reliably, because you got a lot of lawyers and policymakers working it. If it's put on a ballot initiative, whatever the language of the ballot is that passes is the law. And then if you want to finesse it, it's got to be subsequently addressed through the legislative process during each subsequent legislative session. And if it's something that's enacted by the courts, again, I don't have any direct personal experience with this, but, you know, I sort of take issue with assertions that we have five states where aided dying, well, it could be legal, but it's certainly, I don't think it's effective. I mean, I don't think any of us can go down to Albuquerque and avail ourselves of something. You know, it's a mid-level court case. And in Montana, okay, so the Supremes up in Montana made a decision decriminalizing things, but I have no idea. I would like to know, but I don't know, and I don't have the time to research it. You know, what is so up in Montana? You know, did we just have something in the news that a lady in Montana just availed herself of this somehow, maybe found a doc? I don't know.
There are doctors participating, but they're doing it quietly and with no oversight, not the best situation.
Probably not. That was my reference to Oregon, that at least here in the United States, because we are 50 different jurisdictions, right, there are different paths up this mountain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate your insights, Bart, and thank you so much for sharing with us your experience. And so it sounds like a lot more work is needed in the state of Colorado if this law is going to be passed, but that's good for people interested and concerned to know about that people need to step up and get active, and we need to do a lot more educating.
Yeah, and thank you for the time to add to the conversation, Karen. I don't want to overstay my welcome, and unless I have another bit that I want to add, I wouldn't expect to take more of my share of time this afternoon.
Well, feel free if something else comes to mind, Bart, to just press star 2 on your keypad, and I'll know you have something to say.
Okay.
But thank you so much for sharing that information with us.
And you're welcome.
It looks like right now the name that shows up on my caller ID is Jam Schaffhauser from the Twin Cities has a raised hand. And so I'm going to unmute your line so that you can talk with us right now. Hello, are you there?
Is it me?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah, I'm from Twin Cities, but that's not my name. But anyway, this
Oh, okay.
someone else must have had this number long ago. But anyway, I am from Minnesota, and I have a brother with ALS, and also I had a sister and father passed from ALS. And so this, you know, I'm just wondering if there's a central website, or how would I know if this Dying with Dignity is going through any legislature in my state of Minnesota, or, you know, how I would contact the senator, or how that process would be to know where it's at, because it would be really hard for him already in a wheelchair and disabled with ALS to move and live in another state for 6 months, and then being without family or anybody around to go through this process.
That's a good question, and I think I would refer you to the website of Compassion and Choices, the national organization, which I believe has a state-by-state description of what's going on in each state in terms of death with dignity. The National Compassion and Choices organization also has a client support program where they will counsel people in any state about options that are available to them.
Okay.
And
great.
There is also, so that is just compassionandchoices.org, I believe. You could certainly Google it. The other organization that might be of help is called Final Exit Network. And that is just www.finalexitnetwork.org. And Final Exit Network, or FEN as it's often called, also works with people with terminal illnesses, counseling them as to options, and they work in any state.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Arlene, could you clarify? My understanding is that there that the neurological diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, I mean, that there is no state where the death with dignity applies because this is something because the law states that a person has to be in the last 6 months of their life and be able to self-administer. And by the time these neurological diseases, where these people are in the last 6 months of their life, they're so progressed, they may not, you know, they may have dementia, they may not be able to move their own hands and self-administer. Can you just address
right.
that to clarify if I'm correct and might help the person who's just calling in?
You're partially correct. ALS,
yeah.
ALS often does qualify someone for the death with dignity law. Here and in Oregon, we have Compassion and Choices of Washington has had quite a few people with ALS use the law, and that is because doctors are more able to give a six-month prognosis. There are certain landmarks in the disease which lend themselves to giving a prognosis. Diseases like Parkinson's and MS, multiple sclerosis, are so slowly progressive and degenerative that, and they often do carry a dementia along with them. So doctors are very reluctant to give a six-month diagnosis for Parkinson's and MS patients. And ALS, we have had quite a few people qualify with that illness.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Someone actually just contacted me asking me about that. I'm glad you clarified that. Thank you.
Sure.
Right, and my brother had like a feeding tube, so it would have, he could probably somehow just, you know, go right into the feeding tube. And
that is, under the Washington and Oregon laws, that is an acceptable means of self-ingestion. Both Washington and Oregon, and I believe the other states, require that a person must be able to self-administer medication. That's the voluntary act.
Right.
And they can self-administer it through a feeding tube.
Wow.
So I hope that answers your questions. I wish you good luck.
Yes, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your question. So for anyone else out there, I'll just remind you to press *2 on the keypad of your phone if you have a question that you'd like to ask Phyllis or Arlene. And if you're on the webcast, you can type in a question for us. And I have a couple of questions here that or comments too. Dee Evers writes, several European countries, Holland, Belgium, Switzerland, and others have liberal laws regarding this issue, and we lag far behind with only a few states permitting an involved process with the physicians making the final decision. How do you see us as a nation moving more rapidly toward legally hastening one's life in situations that are not terminal but are simply unbearable with no promise of relief? I don't know if either one of you has any comments on that.
Yeah, the caller is certainly correct about the European countries. Many of them do have more liberal laws than we do. The question of assisted death when someone is not terminally ill is very difficult. And I realistically, I don't see our country including that in a death with dignity law. We are a surprisingly conservative country, and there are very influential organizations, religious organizations, who do not agree with death with dignity, and they hold great sway. I think that the organization I mentioned previously, Final Exit Network, is a resource for people in that situation.
Well, another resource is the voluntary stopping eating and drinking.
Yes, of course.
So
thank you.
That should not be overlooked at all, because that's available to everyone, and it's important that that people understand that this is a way to very peacefully, consciously, end one's life without suffering, with the proper medical support. And some hospices will support this, some won't. In our particular personal situation, my husband was at home, and we had a private, we had our doctor, it was our doctor who we had seen for years. She made three house calls during those 9.5 days. She was available 24 hours a day during that time, and we had caregivers. We had round-the-clock caregivers, which probably wouldn't, it could have been handled by myself possibly and other family members, but I think that would have been way too stressful for me, and I was grateful that we were able to have that level of support. But I just think that this is something that we all have to remember. And you know, my husband and we're very well-educated people, and until we learned about DSED from one of the chaplains at Compassion and Choices, we had never heard of it. It wasn't a possibility. When my husband's mother was probably in her 80s, she died at 95. You know, she shriveled away with Alzheimer's. It was horrible. But when she was in her 80s, she spoke to my husband about the possibility of her taking an overdose. And she said, an illegal overdose. She would have, figured out a way to get enough barbiturates, hopefully. And she said the only reason why she didn't do it or wanted what was holding her back was that she was afraid if it didn't work, she would end up even worse than where she was with Alzheimer's. And at that time, and this goes back into I'd say late 90s, early after 2000, my husband nor I had even the wherewithal to say to her, why don't you just stop eating and drinking and we'll make sure you have the best medical care available to you. And in retrospect, because Alan and I talked about this, he felt that if his mother had this knowledge, she would have chosen that. And so, I just think this is something that there's a big – and also – When Alan decided to stop eating and drinking, I felt very bad because he had the prescription for the laryngeal cancer, and he couldn't use it. I would have been an accomplice in murder if he had used the prescription for Alzheimer's. It was illegal, and we knew that. And I remember having a conversation with him about how bad I felt about it, and I asked him, do you feel bad about it? Are you really regretful that you can't use the prescription now, because you're competent enough, you could take the prescription if it had been legal? And he told me that his preference was to have a completely organic death and to stop eating and drinking, and that if he had had his choice of both, he still would have chosen the not eating and drinking.
Phyllis, thank you for bringing that up, and I want to agree with you that voluntarily stopping eating and drinking is a very valid way for people to bring about their own deaths. It's acceptable to the Catholic Church, to the American Medical Association, and to the courts in this country. Many people believe that this will be a very difficult, painful death, but that is not the case. And there have been studies showing this. Compassion and Choices of Washington has a very good handout on stopping eating and drinking. And I believe that's available on our website, which is compassion, compassionwa.org. And there are many documents there that may be of interest. if the voluntary stopping eating and drinking information is not available on the website, you could certainly give us our office a call, and we would make sure that you receive that information.
I believe it is on the website. The last time I looked, the TEDx talk that I gave, which is a story of my husband's decision to stop eating and drinking, and the five choices he made that led up to that. I think it's still on. I think that my TED talk is still on the Compassionate Voices of Washington. I don't know. I think it's still even there. But anyone who wants to watch that TED talk, if they just Google "not here by choice," it will come up. Or they can put my name in, you know, Phyllis Schachter, Schachter, and it will pop up. And it's a very vulnerable and heartfelt talk about my husband's courage and choice.
And I highly recommend the video. It's excellent. If anyone listening hasn't seen it yet, you really should. You really should take a look at it. It's just like 15 minutes long or something, Phyllis.
So yeah, 17 minutes. Yeah,
17 minutes, and totally worth it. Please, please do take a look at it. Well, as we're on this topic, Dee Evers has written in, "Thank you for mentioning Final Exit Network during this program. I think the majority of Americans are not yet aware of this organization, which is primarily run by volunteers and does a fine job with use of their trained exit guides to be with and support those who do not fit the physician aid in dying law but feel the need to leave this world." And so thank you, Dee, for writing in about that. And I'm one of those people who, when you asked a question earlier about Final Exit Network, I didn't know what it was. So I had to ask Arlene and Phyllis if they had heard of it before. So it's something new to me. So thanks for bringing that up. And again, Arlene, you were saying the website is finalexit.org.
Let me check to be sure. Yes, www.finalexitnetwork.org.
Network.org,
and
okay.
I could give you the toll-free number as well, if you'd like.
Sure. If you,
that
yeah,
number is 866-654-9158.
All right. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see, I'm going back to check to see if anyone else. I'll remind you again on the phone to press star 2 on your keypad if you have a question or comment to make. And let's see, I don't see anyone right now, but we do have a comment from the webcast typed in by Lori Kurz. So I'll read this to you. It's fairly long, but I'll read you what Lori had to say. She says, "I am so appreciative of your public stance on this very taboo issue. I do think those with influence, such as doctors, need to write articles for mainstream, non-professional journals and magazines promoting the very views expressed here for a captive audience. It is my observation that the general public is not really informed, have limited resources to learn about it, and are influenced by people with their own agenda. Thank you for providing this opportunity for discussion, but I believe we have to widen the audience to the average person who, for the most part, never hear these in-depth conversations. Short blurbs in papers referring to bills does not help to educate and move people to vote for the bills, as the other side makes the case for the bills are negative and undesirable and counter to humane choices." So, again, kudos for your openness and for providing this forum. So Lori is exactly right, stating that we need much more information out there.
Yes, and I think that we're in great debt to Brittany Maynard for her bravery in facing her own illness and sharing that with the public, sharing the reasons for her choice, and to her husband, who is now continuing to educate people.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's the reason why we're having this conversation today.
Mm-hmm.
Brittany Maynard
mm-hmm.
really inspired this. Tell me, Arlene, does Compassion and Choices have outreach methods? Like, are there things you are doing to get the message out, or for organizations like yours, does it feel like you have to be quiet in a way to not attract negative attention?
That's a good question. We certainly aren't negative here in Washington State because, or hesitant to be public, because we do have the law. And we do a lot of outreach because there are many people in the state that are unaware of their rights under the law. And we feel that everybody should be aware of the law and of their right to use it or choose other ways to hasten death. In terms of the national scene, Compassion and Choices, the national organization is very active in education and putting forth laws and trying to get initiatives passed or laws through legislatures and so forth. But I certainly agree with the caller or the writer that we need more human interest stories, if you will, stories that are accessible to the average person, because people need to know about the potential laws, and I think need to band together because there are a lot of people who support this concept, but they feel perhaps isolated, and they don't know how to act on that support.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's one reason why, Phyllis, your story and putting it out as a YouTube video is so powerful. And if everyone hearing this call would get your video and share it with people they know and make it more available, because it's compelling, because, Phyllis, because it was your husband who went through this process and you're sharing it as a layperson, and so you're sharing all of the beauty and all of the emotions and the pain that you went through in a way that everyone else can relate to and understand. And so you're not talking about it from a theoretical point of view or, you know, from someone even just trying to analyze it from an ethical perspective. It's your real heartfelt experience, and that it's just so very valuable that you've had the courage to share that story.
Thank you. You know, I have a question for you, Karen, and this has come up as a question and an issue, and that is one of my concerns in trying to make it possible for other people to be educated about VSED is hospice's role and whether hospices will participate to help a person at the end of their life. I think that level of medical support is necessary. And I personally have talked with some people who had a mother, family member who, where their hospice did accept their family member into hospice because they were not, they did not have the 6 months terminal illness, but they were either elderly or were getting close to losing mental competency with Alzheimer's, and they were there for them. This is not true of all hospices. And I was wondering, Karen, if you as a retired hospice doctor has this issue come up? I mean, I have thought that I would love to speak at a hospice national conference and share my story there because I'm concerned about having the right support system for people in the future who are going to choose to VSED. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Everyone won't be able to afford a private doctor, and support is necessary.
I think for some hospices, I think it's a bit of a gray area, and that each hospice tends to have their own philosophy, kind of depending on management or the medical director or, you know, whoever has formed the hospice. And Arlene, you made the point that any hospices that are run by the Catholic Church would be Well, I don't know, maybe VSED would be acceptable. But that's something I would like to bring our discussion around to with anyone else who has worked in hospice about why other hospice workers feel reluctant to support a patient who has chosen VSED. And one thing I thought of is that in the past, you know, hospice is struggling to maintain their own positive image in the community and really wanting to be a viable choice for people in the community and wanting to be recognized and viewed. And hospice has been through years of being viewed with fear by people and having a bad reputation in some ways, or at least people thinking of hospice negatively or with fear. And I have, on many occasions, I've heard hospices be accused of overdosing patients, and I've heard people who detract from the idea of hospice as all you hospice workers do is overdose people with morphine, and you're basically terminating their lives earlier than they would have died, and that's what hospice is about. So I think hospice has really struggled to overcome that image in some people's minds and to remind people that's not what hospice does, that's not what hospice is about. Hospice is about maintaining comfort. So then the idea of caring for someone who has decided to use VSED, I think makes people a little bit nervous, like, oh no, now will hospice be taking on a lot of criticism and a lot of negativity if we support a different group of people, and suddenly will we be back in a position of being criticized publicly? I'm not sure if that's how people feel.
Yeah, and the other gray area is that Alan certainly was not in the last 6 months of life.
Yes.
But I think by the third day he was.
He was, yes.
At the third day.
Go ahead, Arlene.
I was going to say, one of the things that when our client support volunteers talk with people contemplating VSED or voluntary stopping eating and drinking, we recommend that they talk with their physicians and get a commitment from the physician that if they do start the process, the doctor will refer them to hospice. Whether or not the hospice will accept them as a client is up to the hospice, of course, and it's quite variable.
It is very variable, Arlene. That happened in our situation, and when push came to shove, basically our hospice said that our doctor's recommendation was basically worthless.
And I think
it really varies on the hospice
and the
medical director.
And I believe that you are in the area where, unfortunately, medical practice is restricted by administrators of hospices and so forth.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's a very important topic. And so obviously we need to have these conversations in the general community, but within the hospice community as well. And it's excellent that you bring this up, Phyllis, because it's something hospice needs to continue to wrestle with and struggle with, because these questions will be coming up more and more frequently in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And hospice needs to understand how to continue helping people and how to continue our mission to provide comfort and quality of life at the end of life for people, regardless of the circumstances that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wonder if any of the conversation goes toward when a hospice turns down a patient like my husband. I wonder if they think it's more compassionate for somebody to live for years with no dignity in a dementia facility on many antipsychotic drugs. When we toured the dementia facility to look at, and I picked the most expensive, best reputable one in our county to go to with Alan as an option before he made his final choice to VSED. And when we had our tour, the administrator who toured us very proudly said, our patients are only on an average of 12 drugs, where the average is 17. She was serious. She really was serious. And it was, I think that as part, this is the issue that I brought up before when the gentleman was speaking from Colorado in terms of pending legislation there about people's fear of thinking about death and dying. I wonder how many people have ever intentionally visited an Alzheimer's dementia facility. I doubt not even 5%, you know, unless they have a relative living in one. And it was a turning point for us. I mean, definitely for my husband. It, within about 15 minutes of us being there, we both were crying and just had to sit down. It was the saddest, one of the saddest human situations I have ever witnessed. And as soon as we left, Alan turned to me and said, I will never live there. And I couldn't even imagine him. I couldn't even imagine as him being there. Even with all the grief that I have experienced over these last years of seeing his decline and after he died, it would be worse to have him in one of those facilities, knowing he had a terminal disease anyway. So these are things that people don't want to think about. They don't want to talk about it. And so I think one of my, reasons for being on this earth today is I'm willing to talk about these things.
Well, Bart, who spoke to us earlier, typed in a comment along these lines saying he feels the overall problem is opacity in the dying marketplace. Related to confusion about hospice, I have long wondered why hospice and palliative care, through their professional associations, haven't undertaken to define and promote their mission. My 2007 state initiative, the Option to Die in Peace, Patient Ethical Alternative Care Elective, proposed a number of things, including a statewide public education campaign. We could all benefit from open advertising regarding flavors of dying services that we can identify and pick from in advance.
Yeah,
that's an excellent idea, Bart, of just that openness in the marketplace of what is out there and what is available. And I'm imagining with the increase in the numbers of people becoming death midwives and death doulas, those may end up being the practitioners who help support a patient and family through VSED, who work outside of the hospice system and have their own private practice. They may end up being the people for now who offer that support if hospice care isn't available.
Mm-hmm.
And that education needs to begin when we're healthy.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's interesting. Nancy from Austin, Texas just typed in. She just got an email notification from the New York Times on an editorial that's related to this discussion, and it's titled Offering a Choice to the Terminally Ill by the editorial board. Healthcare providers in states where assisted suicide is legal face wrenching decisions is the tagline for that article. So that'll be something interesting for us to look up in the New York Times today, apparently, this editorial. So it is interesting. I'm seeing more and more articles being written in the popular press right now. More and more documentaries are being made. I think that we're experiencing a change in the making, but I don't know how many years it's going to take for that momentum to build and for the change to actually happen.
Well, education certainly empowers people. I have a close friend who is also one of the volunteers for Compassion and Choices. Her name is Trudy James, and she is almost done producing a film called Speaking of Dying. And I don't know if it will be her company is called Heartworks. And I don't know if it will be the DVD documentary will be available by Amazon or all the outlets, but it's basically all different facets of looking at preparing for the dying process so that people begin to think about this well in advance for themselves and with their families. And different people from older people to people with neurological disease to doctors, I was interviewed for the film. And it's a wonderful tool that somebody could actually take and sit with their family or friend and watch, and it would be a wonderful framework for initiating conversation so that important decisions can be made and put in people's health directives. It's called Speaking of Dying. It will be premiered on April 16th.
All right, that's a good resource to know about. There's another comment that's been typed in about just along this subject line regarding hospice. This comment is, I have been a hospice chaplain. Hospice does not want to fall into that dark box of being a place to die. That initial fear has taken the hospice movement to a fairly long time to become accepted as a place to live until you die. Additionally, since the topic of death and anything related to death is still taboo in general society, the average person does not bring up the issue. As a chaplain, I have heard all too often when someone, perhaps even the dying person, wants to discuss death, they are hushed. And so so this person is just pointing out that the hospice is really responding to the fact that death and dying is still fairly taboo in our society. And I think we're all going through this process, this growing process of how do we change our way of thinking.
We change it by going through the motions of doing it and talking about it. That's another reason why Death Cafe is good, because it's a forum for people to come together. It's very hard for a lot of people to begin to talk about these things with their mother. I was in my 50s when I took care of my mother, who was really role modeled a beautiful death at 95 and a half. I hope I can die as peacefully as she did. But even in my 50s, I wasn't as comfortable as I was when I was helping Alan in my 60s to have the kind of conversation that Alan and I had. I still wasn't comfortable yet enough to have all that conversation with my own mom. And I wish I had.
That's a good point, Phyllis, that really as our baby boom generation ages, that's one of the reasons why we're having this discussion more and more frequently, because we're getting older and we're becoming more comfortable talking about it, and the need to talk about it is increasing.
Mm-hmm. And I think the baby boom generation is one who wants to have control over their lives.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So that, which is why these death with dignity laws are going to become more and more in the forefront and more important over time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's another comment here from Joanna Brown. She typed in, I assisted a friend who had been admitted to a Catholic hospital via ambulance and had three life-limiting conditions. After 3 days, she decided to stop medications and enter hospice care. The medical staff there threatened to hold her down, to force IV medication on her, and only stopped this threat when a lawsuit was proposed. They also attempted to block her being transferred to a hospice where she could have stopped treatment. I believe it is important to let people know that in this case, a hospital chose to limit a patient's choices based on their religious principles. For this reason, I would never choose to enter that Catholic hospital for any reason. Another note, this woman did not have a copy of her medical proxy form or living will that could be accessed as this crisis was going on. It is so important to go to pulst.org and click on your state to fill out a pulst or MOLST form and have it with you, as well as with your medical proxy. So that's an almost terrifying story for me to hear, that
those
someone would be denied their right to.
Very good suggestion. I'm sorry to interrupt. Very good suggestion
to
go to your own state's documents and complete them. I think, unfortunately, this is not an uncommon story, because medical care in this country is increasingly being controlled by private interests, often religious interests, which restrict the kind of health care that people can get.
Mm-hmm.
I think in this situation, and the writer is very correct in saying, don't go to hospitals where your choices will be limited. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, and we see this in Washington State, they don't have a choice of where to go for their medical care. They may be in a rural community where the medical care is all controlled by entities which restrict the kinds of services that people can get. I think if this does happen, this is something that Compassion and Choices National Organization wants to hear about and wants to work on so that this doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. These are circumstances that need to be brought to light because mm-hmm. it's just not acceptable in any way that a person's right to choose hospice would be denied them
right.
By a hospital system.
Mm-hmm.
Along these lines, wow, we're getting such incredible comments and stories
mm-hmm.
here. Ada typed in also, I'm so appreciative to you people who took the time to type in all this information for us. I just want to thank you so very, very much for doing that for us because you're giving us so much, so much information for this discussion. Ada typed in, when I was 36 years old, I was diagnosed with a beginning leukemia. I had a 6-year-old son and was a single mother. The treatment, bone marrow transplant, chemotherapy, and full body radiation would have completely taken me away from my son for 2 years. I was told that without immediate treatment, I would die within 6 months, maximum 2 years. The chances to survive treatment were slim. After careful consideration, I chose not to undergo treatment and to consciously die instead. I chose this so that I could use the time I had left to be with my son, to strengthen and prepare my little boy for the time after his mom would be gone. I have since recovered naturally and completely and have lived to see my son grow into a wonderful 24-year-old adult. I had something to die for, the life of my son, which led me to embrace my own mortality. I wonder, and this is my question, how can we help society, all of us, to become more comfortable with mortality? Death is so excluded from our life, yet it is an integral part to it. I believe that if mortality wouldn't be such a taboo, all questions around death and dying would be so much less explosive, and people in my situation would probably have support, which back then was not available to me at all. I was totally alone in my fears around coping with my approaching death, and I got attacked from many sides for the choices I had made. Wow. Ada,
wow.
That's an extremely powerful story, and I'm so grateful to you for sharing that. And in my opinion, you're exactly right. If we were a society that could face mortality and death and talk about it more easily, and if we, from childhood on, understood death as just a natural part of life, it would change everything. It would change all of these discussions that we're having.
That's right. I mean, some cultures understand and are taught at a young age about impermanence, that everything is impermanent. Everything evolves into something else. It's taught at a young age. That's an extraordinary story.
Yes, and I think we have to rejoice that the writer is still with us. And, despite her fears, she was able to overcome this illness, and it is very sad that she did not have support along the way.
What was her illness?
Beginning leukemia, I believe.
Yeah, leukemia.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think about Alan, who healed from laryngeal cancer in 4 months. I mean, the allopathic perspective is one perspective. It is not the truth.
Absolutely. And we need far more support for patients making their own choices about treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And patients foregoing treatment needs to be an option that's offered to patients, because treatment isn't right for everyone. And as Ada described, she followed her heart and her intuition, which told her against everyone's advice. And I'm sure it took tremendous courage to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous. It's extraordinary.
Yes, yes. Just a beautiful story. I'm so grateful.
I mean,
for
Alan
you.
Had my support. She didn't have somebody like me by her side.
Yeah.
Supporting, you know, when other people were criticizing us. I mean, it's just amazing. What is her name?
Ada, A-Y-D-A.
And where does she live?
New York City.
Uh-huh. My heart goes to you, Ada, with deepest respect.
And gratitude. Thank you.
Gratitude.
Thank you for sharing that with us. A couple more people mentioned the importance of patients and individuals. Tammy, who's an RN, wanted us to talk about the importance of patients and individuals signing a PULSED directive, which is physician's order for life-sustaining treatment. And Gretchen reminded us that PULSED and MOLST forms must be signed by a healthcare provider to take effect. They can't be done independently, which is a thank you for that, Gretchen, because that's an excellent reminder that you can complete the form, but you must have your physician sign it.
That's also a reminder that PULSED or MOLST forms carry a great deal of weight because the doctor signs it, and that makes it, in essence, doctor's orders.
Yes.
Arlene, do you think that somebody who's not ill, that it's important? I have a very detailed health directive, very detailed, that was updated after my husband died from everything that I learned, but I don't have a PULSED form. My health directive is far more detailed than my PULSED form.
Mm-hmm. I think that question comes up frequently, and I think that generally the PULSED form, which is what it's called in Washington State, is recommended for people who are ill and who would not want aggressive treatment should they have some sort of crisis. It's
right.
In Washington State, it's a bright green form that's filled out with the doctor, and you keep it in your own home, most often taped to your refrigerator or above your bed. It notifies whomever comes in. If someone calls 911 for emergency medical care, that form is something that the EMTs look for and will respect. So that can help you avoid unwanted treatment. Our clients who are all facing terminal illnesses often choose to use that form to indicate that they want only comfort care, not aggressive care.
And that's in addition to their health directive.
Yes, yes. And because of that, because it's most often used to reject aggressive treatment, it's not recommended for people who are healthy and who... You know, if you had, for example, Phyllis, if you had a broken hip or a heart attack or a stroke, I would suspect that you would want aggressive treatment, which is what you would get if you didn't have a PULSED form suggesting otherwise.
Right. And that was my understanding, too. I really appreciate your clarifying that. I think that distinction is really important.
Yeah, the other situation in which the form is often used by people who are very, very elderly and frail but not terminally ill.
Right.
And sometimes folks like that will say, gosh, I've lived a good life. If I have a heart attack, just let me go. Don't pound on my chest. So even though they do not have a terminal illness, they may choose to reject any aggressive treatment in the event of some crisis.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for clarifying that.
Mm-hmm.
Bart Windram also typed in, be sure to notarize any and all advance directives, whether or not your state requires notarization, because he's pointing out your neighboring state might require notarization and something might happen to you when you're visiting outside the state. And he says, you just can't be too careful.
Good
Any
recommendation.
And all forms should be notarized.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, that's excellent given how all of us are pretty mobile these days and do a lot of traveling, and you never know when something could happen to you out of state.
Whenever I travel now, I carry my health directive with me. It's just in my suitcase, and I have one in my car.
Yeah, good idea. Could I add something about advance directives? Obviously, each state has their own form. In Washington State, Compassion and Choices has developed a very detailed advance directive, which allows you to combine in one document durable power of attorney for health care, that is a surrogate decision maker, and an advance directive or living will. That document is available on the Compassion and Choices of Washington website, and it may not apply in other states, but it will give you an idea of questions to consider. The other thing I think is very unique to Washington is an Alzheimer's / dementia advance directive, which, again, Compassion and Choices developed this document designed for people who are in the early stages of dementia or who have a very strong family history of dementia or Alzheimer's. And it addresses things like, how do you want your care financed? Would you want to be in a care facility or cared for at home? When should your keys be taken? These kinds of questions. And that also is available on the Compassion and Choices of Washington website. I would suggest that people take a look at that. It also stimulates a lot of discussion and things that people may not have considered previously.
Yeah, I just would like to add that it's an excellent form, and I feel personal gratitude to Compassion and Choices and the people who developed it. I think my husband was one of the first people to use that form.
Good. Yeah, it's endorsed by the Alzheimer's Association and used by them here in this state.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm looking through our comments here. Lori Kuras, who's the hospice chaplain and Death Cafe facilitator. Thank you for doing the Death Cafe, Lori. If only the people who remain uncomfortable with death would hear what you have to say, where might they read your words and thoughts? I hope you have articles in mainstream magazines. I'll just let you know, Lori, I have a website, KarenWyattMD.com, and I have a lot of articles and blogs on that website. And I also blog for the Huffington Post, so that's where I do have some blogs visible there to the mainstream. I don't know how well they get read, but I am trying to put more and more content out there. And then I have the End of Life University interview series, 2 interviews a month that go on that are free and available for people to listen to. And I host a virtual Death Cafe once a month where people can call in, and we do a Death Cafe over the phone, somewhat similar to what we're doing right here. So those are the things I have going on, and you can learn more about the End of Life University at EOLUniversity.com. So those are the things I'm trying to put out there for the world, doing what I can to try to share this information. So thanks for asking about that.
I think also there's a lot of information on the internet about death and dying, and I think one of the things that's come up in this conversation is the need for articles and outreach to just everyday people to kind of demystify death with dignity and hospice and the whole subject of end of life. So I'm hoping that we can do better with that.
And, you know,
yeah.
That makes sense, Arlene, that, I mean, everyone out there, everyone who's on this call should actually consider, do you have Is there even a community paper or magazine where you live that you could contribute an article to, or a newsletter for an organization that you belong to that you could contribute an article to or write a piece for? If every one of us made some sort of commitment to put information out and factual information that just informs people about these issues, I think that would go a long way.
Also, in Washington State, Compassion and Choices of Washington does a lot of outreach, and we have speakers who go to churches or Older Women's League or Lions Clubs and so forth to educate people. We're very happy to go anywhere in the state at no charge. So if you happen to be in Washington, would like to have a speaker for your group, give our office a call.
In fact, I'm going to be going, I will be representing Compassion and Choices in May, going to a Unitarian Universalist church in Port Townsend, doing
that.
And all the speakers are going to be speaking about different facets of Alzheimer's.
Good.
Yeah.
And I know Bart Windrum, who joined us on the call, he's doing workshops and webinars and speaking to groups as well, and also has a TEDx video out there. So I know there are people doing what they can in their own area, and we all just need to keep it going, and maybe we all need to share one another's work also as much as we possibly can, like sharing Phyllis's video and sending it out to everyone on our list and making sure other people have a chance to see it and hear about it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We had a comment from Rain Johnson, who's in Edmonton, Alberta. And she wrote, she's an educator of end-of-life issues in Alberta, Canada, and has hosted numerous death cafes and now a death and dying film series, which is fantastic. I've been encouraging that. I think everyone should have a film series in their community because film is such a great way to spread the word. I find more and more people willing and wanting to talk more about death and dying, and now that we have had a bill pass here in Canada that makes assisted dying legal, this has opened up a whole new conversation. And that's true, Rain. Canada is definitely ahead of us here in the U.S., and I've been impressed because I've been in contact with a lot of death midwives and death doulas and people in the death movement in Canada, and I feel like you have a jump on us a little bit. You're a bit ahead of us.
Yes.
But we're working on it. We're doing what we can here.
May I mention a movie which I strongly recommend? It's called How to Die in Oregon.
Yeah.
And it follows a woman who chose to use the Oregon Death with Dignity Law. Follows her from the time early in her illness and how she and her family deal with that illness, and follows her through her hastened death. And it's won some awards at Sundance, and it's a very well done movie, available, I believe, on Netflix.
Yeah. And what was the name again?
How
to Die in Oregon. All right. Hmm.
And Karen, the woman who just, I don't know if she called in or wrote in about the film series in Canada, is there an actual film series that she was involved in producing, or could we get the name of this film series, or can we get a little bit more information?
Sure. Rain, if you're still listening, could you type in for us maybe a link of where we could find out more about your Death and Dying film series?
I'm personally very interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I am as well, so that would be great if we could get that.
Yeah. Let's see. We're getting a lot more. No one so far is raising their hands again to to talk with us, so I keep reading the comments here, but so many people have been typing in their comments.
Can I bring something up? Can I bring up a question?
Yes.
Okay. Well, and I would like to talk a little bit about the actual VSED process as a means of education for other people. And, when my husband actually died, I'm not going to go into the day-by-day detail, although I have that written down about what happened during the 9.5 days that it took him. But I think one of the things that people ask me a lot about is, you know, did my husband suffer or was he in pain? And my understanding, and this was certainly the case in the situation with Alan, is that he wanted to be as conscious as possible for as long as he could. And hunger does not cause pain, but dehydration definitely can cause pain as the body is beginning to break down. And my understanding also was that it would have been completely legal, and maybe Arlene, you can comment about this, that it would have been completely legal for Alan to have been fairly sedated throughout the process, so that he didn't really even know really what was going on. But that is not the same as sedating to unconsciousness. And so he wanted to be as conscious as possible. That wasn't his choice, but I know that there are people that when I'm talking with them, you know, they say, well, that I'd be afraid, you know, to do that. And I think about for myself, and a lot of the comments that came after Alan had died, there were many comments, very favorable comments about his choice. And one of them is that a lot of people felt deep relief that this choice is available to them someday if necessary. So I'm just wondering if from where, you know, you sit with the whole compassion and choices and your knowledge that you get through some of the medical doctors and so forth, if you could address that kind of fine line between sedating to unconsciousness or being fairly sedated so that you're not really fully understanding what's going on, but you're not unconscious. Can you address that, or is that not in your league?
I can certainly try. I think people do have a very negative reaction when they hear that somebody has chosen to stop eating and drinking. excuse me. It's not a difficult process. The dying body does not need food and hydration in the same way that a healthy body does. Appetite naturally wanes. Presenting people with food when they're in the last stages of life can often make them feel nauseated. The same is true with hydration, and there have been multiple studies and articles in nursing journals that forcing fluids when someone is terminally ill or when they're stopping eating and drinking can cause more harm than good. Hydration can cause edema throughout the body. It can cause people to become congested and have secretions in their throat and chest that they're too weak to clear. So stopping hydration will cause some symptoms early on, but those can be easily handled. We talked about hospice being involved in this kind of situation, and that would be the ideal, because hospice is good about mitigating any symptoms that are difficult for people when they stop eating and drinking. If hospice is not available, hopefully there would be a sympathetic physician, as Phyllis and Alan had. The question of sedation is a difficult one, because certainly sedating someone to the point of unconsciousness, that often is called palliative sedation, is a drastic procedure or treatment, which is rarely offered to people, only in the extreme circumstances of intractable pain or other circumstances. But certainly some degree of sedation, it's perfectly legal and acceptable if a physician is willing to prescribe that.
But what was explained to us at the beginning of the process was that the relationship between a patient and a doctor is a private relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And there is pain that a patient is experiencing that they can request pain medication.
Sure.
And the doctor can respond And certainly, I mean, and that my husband had had a lot of dental work prior to his starting his fast, and he was already on some Vicodin, and actually the medication that she was started was actually weaker than the Vicodin that he had already been on. But my understanding is that it's a legal and private relationship between the patient and the doctor, and I know one of my biggest concerns and a concern for our doctor was that Alan not suffer.
Sure, and a person should not suffer. I mean, that's a given, and hopefully, if someone is going to voluntarily stop eating and drinking, they would have a sympathetic provider to help them
right.
with that. I think, in my experience, I've worked with I think 6 folks who have voluntarily stopped eating and drinking, and for them, it has not been a difficult process. I think if we think about religious groups who often have fasting as part of their religious rituals,
yeah.
and people who fast often report a kind of euphoria during their fast. And we have seen this in people who are voluntarily stopping eating and drinking as well. They report a kind of euphoria after the first few days of the experience.
Well, one of the things that actually happens is called ketosis when you started to fast. I don't know I can't give you the physiological description, but that did happen to Alan. He did have that. And if anything, it was a little strange because his mind actually got a little clearer
as a result
during that phase. One of the other things that, and this was advice that we were given by a volunteer doctor of Compassion and Choices, and it was good advice. And my husband did this. For 5 days prior to him starting the process, he ate no more than 500 calories a day.
Mm-hmm.
And he it made the process, I think, go along a little faster and easier for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, he kind of began to lose his attachment in that way to food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one thing that happens, you're right, Phyllis, the process of ketosis is simply because the body converts to metabolizing fat cells within the body for its source of energy.
Right.
When there's no food present to metabolize, and a byproduct of metabolizing fat are ketones that circulate through the bloodstream, and that's where we get the term ketosis, because there are a higher number of ketones than normal, and the ketones in the bloodstream do have the effect of creating a euphoria and also taking away hunger. So a person fasting might feel hunger the first 36 hours or so, but once their body shifts into ketosis, the hunger pangs go away, and so there's no discomfort from that. There actually is this euphoria. And Nancy had typed in, I thought that dehydration could cause euphoria. It's actually the starvation that can cause euphoria because of
right.
the ketones, Nancy. Dehydration is uncomfortable mainly because of dryness of the mouth. That's an uncomfortable feeling, and the sensation of thirst that comes when your mouth is very, very dry, if you've experienced that before. And so that's why we use sprays for the mouth and swabs and moisturizers for the lips to just help counteract those symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be very effective. And I think, Phyllis, you mentioned that was very helpful for Alan with the dry mouth.
We absolutely did that. And an interesting thing is that on the 4th and 5th day, on both of those days, Alan was conscious. He knew what he was doing. And he asked me for water. And I said to him, I reminded him about why he was doing what he was doing. And then I said to him, but of course, I'll give you a glass of water. Or would you rather have me just spray some mist of water into your mouth until you're satisfied, or I'll swab your mouth? And then he was able to make his choice on both of those days, and he said, no, just use the water, the mist. And I would just keep spraying it, and he would lap it up, and I'd spray more, and he'd lap it up, and maybe that went on 10 times until he said, that's enough. And so, that definitely came up. Mm-hmm. That was on the fourth and fifth days.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, as Arlene mentioned, that every patient in the dying process that I've cared for in hospice stops eating and drinking. And the body simply can't tolerate it anymore, and they lose their ability to swallow and drink. And so we use the very same, the swabs and moisturizers and sprays to counteract dry mouth for those patients at the end of life. But that's a normal process that the body goes through, the normal cessation of eating and drinking, because the body doesn't need it any longer.
So, Karen, what I hear you saying is that VSED is a completely organic, natural way to die.
It is. I mean, it ends up actually being the way that most of us will die. Most of our hospice patients die as a result of no longer being able to eat or drink.
Right. And so the only difference with what Alan did is he consciously made that choice and was not in the last 6 months of life, but was making a decision just not to live into those last stages of Alzheimer's.
Yes, yes.
So it was a very, very compassionate way for him to end his life.
I had a person call me and tell me that he spent some time with the Cherokee tribe.
Uh-huh.
And was talking to some of the elders of that tribe, and they told him it was the custom in the old days that older people would leave the tribe and go off and just wander away to die when they knew it was their time to go, and that they made a decision about when that time was, when they felt that they were more of a burden to the tribe than they were a contributor. When they felt that they could no longer contribute to the good of the entire tribe, but that they were actually being a burden and withdrawing more from the tribe than they could give back, that's when they knew that it was their time. And then they would just go off alone in solitude and die. But again, also because they were not eating and drinking, that's actually what would contribute to their death and possibly exposure to the elements. But
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in other cultures, it's not such a foreign idea. It's not such a difficult concept.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful book. I unfortunately forget the name of it. Written, by about Ralph and I believe Helen Nearing, who he lived. I don't know, I think he lived in Canada, and at the age of 98, when he could no longer chop wood anymore and couldn't do the useful things that he could do and his body was getting weaker, he told his wife he was done and he just stopped eating and drinking. He didn't have the level of medical support either that we had, but it just was the natural thing to do.
I think that there's a lot of wisdom in some of these traditions, but we have wonderful medical care in this country, but unfortunately, we've also medicalized dying.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
People who made these decisions in other cultures or in times past were able to accomplish what a lot of people now would like to accomplish just by following traditional paths.
Yes. Well, our time is drawing near to the end, and I wanted to just read a couple more comments that we have here. Jean Ellen wrote that there are great movies listed at pdxdeathcafemovies.com if anyone wants a place to go online to look up end-of-life movies. So that's pdxdeathcafemovies.com. And then Gretchen wrote, there's a grassroots community group in Portland, Oregon, who is organizing a day-long event around end-of-life issues for the public in October. It's very exciting to see many people interested in talking and learning about death and how to prepare and plan for mortality. And you can go to deathok.com for more information about that event.
Is that the letters okay or okay?
Yes, the letters death and the letters okay.com.
Okay. Great, thank you.
And then after April 16th, there'll be the documentary and film called Speaking of Dying, which is going to be about a 30-35 minute documentary that will cover all the facets, many of the facets that we're talking about today to help people comfortably begin conversation with their family and friends and to begin to make their own preparations.
And then Rain Johnson answered our request for more information about the film, festival she's doing from Edmonton, Alberta. She said the first film was Death Makes Life Possible, and we Skyped in Marilyn Schlitz during our discussion time. I have an interview with Marilyn about that movie in the archives for End of Life University. The second film was Grief Walker by Stephen Jenkinson. The third film will be Family Undertaking. And Rain said, my Facebook page is Coach for End of Life Matters or Death Films YEG, I think, if I reading that correctly. And she said, you can always contact me, rain@tearcups.com. And Rain is spelled R-A-Y-N-E, rain@tearcups.com. Thank you. Thanks, Rain, for typing that in.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's not the same woman, though, that healed.
No,
that was Ada.
New York City. Yeah, and we're so grateful for her story. Nancy from Austin is asking if this will be recorded, and yes, it will be. We've recorded the entire thing, and it'll be posted. I'll send out an email to everyone who has signed up on the End of Life University mailing list with the link so that you can listen back to the conversation, and it will be posted on that website forever
so even for non-members.
Yes, you don't have to be a
non-members, Karen.
Yes, and
okay.
You'll receive the link, and you can share it with anyone. And I'll also send you the URL for the web page on the website End of Life University, where it will be located.
Okay, this was a good conversation. I so appreciate your making this possible.
Yes, I second that.
Yes, it's been fantastic. And one more, Kim Adams wanted me to share that she's doing a monthly webinar called Vital Conversations, Dialogues on Living and Dying Well, and I was one of her guests. And you can go to yourgriefandlosscoach.com to find out about her series. And that's Kim Adams from Boston. So, wow, what fantastic participation we've had from everyone on the call. I am so grateful to everyone who's been here and taken the time to type in your messages. Thank you. We all appreciate that. And then especially Phyllis Schachter and Arlene Hinckley, thank you both very, very much. First, for the original interviews that you did with me, and then for being here for all this time today and sharing all of your knowledge and your expertise with us. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome. I'm grateful that you invited me, Karen.
Well, I appreciate it. It's been a wonderful discussion, and for me, every time I do something like this, I am the one who ends up learning so much. So I just thank all of you, and I really enjoyed this process. So to all of you, take care, and keep watching your emails. If you've signed up for the End of Life University list, you'll get more information about upcoming interviews. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
All right.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
The moderator has left the conference.